Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Genocide. The very word causes one to shudder. But what causes a group to target another with death, displacement, and persecution? Well, that's been the focus of my guest today. Norman Neymark is a professor of East European history at Stanford University, where he directs the Global Studies Division. He's also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and a specialist on World War II-era Soviet history. He's the author of several books, including The Russians in Germany on the Soviet occupation of Germany after World War II, Fires of Hatred, a comparative study of ethnic cleansing in the 20th century Europe, and Stalin's Genocides. He's currently at work on a world history of genocide for Oxford University Press. He'll be lecturing on his current work when he gives the Cadenhead Settle Memorial Lecture in History this evening at 7:30 at the University of Tulsa's Terrell Hall Auditorium. Norman Neymark is our guest today. Norman Neymark, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
You've written extensively on the immediate post-World War II era, especially where it regards the former Soviet Union and its occupation of Eastern Europe. And in recent years, you've been delving into the idea of genocide and what causes genocides and some genocides that we really don't know about. What spurred your interest in that particular field?
Well, I think it was a combination of a lot of different things. But primarily in the mid-1990s, I was, like many other people, beginning of the 1990s, shocked by what went on in Bosnia. I had been, when I was a graduate student, one of my professors, dear professor, took me to Yugoslavia a couple times, and I spent some time up in the mountains on some archaeological digs, working with multinational groups of archaeologists and scholars. And we all got along great. And if you had asked me then, can there be a war between the different peoples of Yugoslavia, I would have said, no way. You know, Serbs, Croats, Muslims, and others got along fabulously. And so it was a genuine shock to me and a genuine shock to a lot of people, and I think a genuine shock to people in Yugoslavia, that in fact the country could fall apart in the way it fell apart, people killing each other in the way they killed each other. So then that presented a huge question to me. How does this happen? You know, how do these multinational communities that seem to operate and function well, even our own, how do they then fall apart and people start killing each other? So that became a kind of intellectual obsession, if you will, with me to try to understand this. And the way to historians try to understand these kind of questions is often with comparative history. So I started comparing with other episodes in history that I knew something about but not a lot, like the Holocaust, like the Armenian Genocide, like what happened in World War II in Eastern Europe. And I started to think about, well, how do these things happen and how does ethnic cleansing or genocide take place?
Are there comparisons to the Ottoman Empire, the end of the Ottoman Empire? Because at that point you had, if not full-blown genocides, there was a genocide against Armenians, but there were also pogroms, or you could call them genocides, against Greeks or any other outsiders in that whole Ottoman territory. Yugoslavia the same way. It had been a loose confederation of a lot of ethnic groups. All of a sudden it falls apart, and the dominant group is fighting to keep control.
Well, I think that analysis has some merit to it. It is true, of course, that at the end of the Ottoman Empire, you know, there were the Balkan Wars, two sets of Balkan Wars, much fratricidal killing between the peoples in the Balkans. But, you know, interwar Yugoslavia was a country that operated not well, but within reason. In the Second World War, there was also problems,
yes,
obviously,
Croatians,
between Serbs and Croats and Muslims. But the new Yugoslavia that was built after the Second World War, you know, by all indications, you know, was a relatively successful political entity. And many people had hoped that that would end, you know, this kind of, again, fratricidal killing among peoples in the region. And indeed, there was a lot of intermarriage. There was a lot of cultural interchange. You didn't have a lot of the sense, you know, of the earlier periods, you know, of domination of the Turks, of another, you know, of the peoples of the region. The region had emerged. There were historical origins of what you might call Yugoslavism. That it fell apart so quickly and in such a bloody way, I still think, you know, even if you talk about the longer history of the Balkans and fighting is tragedy, didn't have to happen and was, as I said, a surprise, you know, in many ways.
Well, you think about Sarajevo.
Right.
1984, it hosts the world coming together right. in peace in the Winter Olympics. And within a decade, it's the subject of a siege. I always recall Elie Wiesel was on this program about that time. He says, you know, look how far man has come. We started our century in Sarajevo. We're ending our century in Sarajevo. It was a very poignant statement. And it's kind of depressing. You know, we've had all these international commissions that have tried to make man more civil, and yet these incidents still occur.
No, absolutely. I think that's right. And, you know, we did end it in Sarajevo, but on a different note than the high note of the Winter Olympics.
Yeah.
It's a good example, by the way. I don't think there was any commentary at that Winter Olympics about conflicts between Serbs and Croats and Muslims or anything like that. My memory doesn't take me back quite that far, but I wouldn't imagine that people would have said, okay, you know, this is really a dangerous situation that could explode into people killing each other. That's unimaginable at that time.
Well, has genocide always been around? As long as man has been around, has there always been genocide?
I mean, that's my view. I started out this work on a fairly narrow basis. As I said, I started with Bosnia, and then I started comparing with other cases in 20th century Europe, including Russia and in the Armenian case of the Armenian genocide. And then people started asking me questions. Well, what about the Aborigines? And what about the American Indians? And what about this and what about that? And I realized immediately that this was a world phenomenon, and not just a world phenomenon, that one that went back in history deep into man's past. And so I started looking into it, you know, and you read the Old Testament. I mean, the Old Testament is full of bloody genocidal episodes of the most horrible sort, you know, where the Old Testament God says, you know, kill them all, kill every one of them, man, woman, child, animals, everything, and insists on a kind of mass destruction of certain peoples. The Greeks, the Romans, you know, you get the same invocations to killing all people. So, you know, my conclusion then is that this is indeed a worldwide phenomenon. It doesn't belong to just one area of the world, that it's a phenomenon that starts from the very beginning of human civilization. We don't know exactly about prehistoric man, but, I mean, there's a lot of evidence that, you know, modern man, as it were, Homo sapiens, killed off the Neanderthals. I mean, there's evidence that happened. Archaeological evidence is too spare. Apparently, this is not my closest field, mind you, but what I've read is that the archaeological evidence is too spare to really make firm conclusions about, in quotes, genocide in prehistoric times. Clearly, people killed people, massacred people, but we don't know about genocide, meaning the purposeful destruction of a group of people. But, you know, my basic hypothesis, the proposition under which I operate is that, you know, humans in society commit genocide.
Is it evolutionary? I mean, you know, the whole idea of competition for sparse resources, does that play into it? Or is it something more elemental?
I think it's all of the above. I don't think it's easy to isolate certain factors in human civilization and human society that make genocide part and parcel of our history. Sometimes I think it's the very fact that genocide has occurred, that it can occur again, that people can conceive of it. You know, they do read it in their Bibles and they do read it in their ancient histories. We do know about Roman destruction of Carthage and, you know, salting the earth and all that sort of thing. So those examples then, you know, to some political leaderships are attractive. And, you know, they take models for other models. The students and I read together sometimes a lot of these social psychological experiments, you know, that went on in the 60s in particular. You can't do these kinds of experiments anymore. But, you know, many of those experiments, the Milgram experiment and at Stanford, the Stanford prison experiment, show that people in society, in certain societies, shaped in certain kinds of ways, will do certain kinds of nasty things. So the Stanford prison experiment, which was basically a bunch of students playing
prisoners,
wardens,
and guards, yeah,
persecuting guards, and other students playing prisoners, pretty soon they adapted those roles so perfectly that they had to stop the experiment because the prison guards were persecuting and terrorizing the prisoners, even though this was play acting. Well, you know, you take yourself up to Abu Ghraib, and that same kind of human behavior in certain kinds of social situations creates a certain kind of brutality. You take that on a larger scale for genocide, and certain kinds of social situations in certain kinds of countries, you know, will produce certain kinds of actions that will lead countries, I think, to genocide. So in that sense, it's built into civilization, it's built into society. I don't think, by the way, it's necessarily built into us. I mean, we have the capability of it, of course, but we have the capability of enormous good. So I think what happens is when we get together in bigger groups, there's trouble.
My guest today is Norman Amark, a professor of Eastern European history at Stanford. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and director of Stanford's Global Studies Division, author of a number of books. He's currently working on a world history of genocide for Oxford Press. He's giving the Caden Head Settle Memorial Lecture in History tonight at 7:30 in Terrell Hall Auditorium on a world history of genocide. Well, what was perhaps the most unusual episode of this behavior manifesting itself? I mean, as you began looking at a wider picture, is there something that was surprising to you, or probably the more you read, the less surprising it got?
I think the latter.
Yeah.
The more I read, the more familiar the patterns. With that said, I continue to be shocked by the awfulness and the brutality of human behavior towards others. So let's think about this for a second. Most cases of genocide, not all, but most cases of genocide, you have armed, powerful people suppressing or killing unarmed civilians. So what gets me probably more than anything about genocide is that fact, the utter brutality that human beings can express and carry out against human beings who are no threat at all to them. None. This is not war where people have guns on both sides and are shooting each other or trying to kill each other or, you know, a struggle between two branches of the human family, right? That's not what's going on. What's going on are these people are utterly innocent and not able to defend themselves at all. Yet human beings will do to them the most awful thing. I mean, the most recent thing I read, I mean, I was reading, with my class some stuff about the conquistadors in Caribbean and in Mexico. So not only do they capture the Indians, brutalize them, kill them in large numbers, but they torture them in the most horrendous ways that you can imagine. The Indians have no ability to resist them whatsoever. They've been conquered. They're captured. Yet, you know, human beings will do to them things that are just unimaginable. I mean, the tortures are unimaginable. And we get accounts of these. You know, there was a bishop by the name of De las Casas who was very much in opposition to the way the Indians were being treated, mostly out of religious reasons. And De las Casas wrote this incredible description of what the Spanish were doing to them. And it was the most horrible brutalities that you could.
No pretense of extracting information about where the gold was they expected
to find. This was just for being
evil
Indians and evil and other, you know, not for any other reason. And you can say the same thing. You know, you can take yourself up to the Nazis who did things, you know, to the Jews. For absolutely. I mean, we have this image, you know, of a kind of industrial killing. Efficient and fast and all that, but the individual brutalities that were carried out, especially on the Eastern Front, that continues to get to me. You know, that one-sided brutality of the person with power against the person without power.
You know, earlier you talked about Old Testament, and I was doing a little reading about this, and I was shocked to see that even as late as the 1800s, there's instances of genocide in Africa where those Old Testament incidents happened, where I think it was the Zulus at that particular time were going through what's now South Africa and Zimbabwe and taking rival tribes, killing every person, all possessions,
right. Even
the dogs. And it just struck me, I mean, doing everything but salting the earth.
Right.
Was flabbergasting.
Yes. Yeah, and it's not just, primitive peoples. I mean, the Maori also were known for, massacring whole peoples in the 19th century, just wiping them out. It was part of their culture and their civilization. But if you take, what's considered now to be the first genocide of the 20th century, and this is the Germans in Southwest Africa, what is today Namibia, against the Herero and Nama people. Terrible brutalities, awful slaughter, purposeful killing of the sort that you can only label it a genocide. So, like I said, it belongs to human civilization, and our job is to make sure, as part of that civilization, that it doesn't happen, first of all, where we live, and second of all, as best we can,
anywhere. Yeah. What constitutes a genocide? Because I know this is a big subject of debate. Even the atrocities that occurred in the Yugoslavia, some places like Srebrenica, it is considered a genocide, but not the whole conflict itself. You have scholars debating things like the Irish potato famine, which some believe was a genocide, and people say, well, that was the little bug, the potato blight. But actually, what you read is that Ireland had enough food to feed itself. The English refused to close the ports. The prices rose because of the blight. The food was exported, and there was not enough to eat. And, of course, they're debating whether that was a genocide or not. What, in your mind, does constitute a genocide?
It's obviously the what used to be called the $64,000 question, right? And now is the $640 million question or whatever. Definition is always a big problem with genocide. Without going into too much detail, let me just say I work from the December 48 definition in the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide that the UN passed in 48, but with a kind of expanded version of that. That version says essentially, and by the way, it's then interpreted by the courts, especially in the 1990s, further interpreted by the courts, and updated by the courts, like the Constitution. It's got to be updated. It should be updated anyway by contemporary circumstances and questions. But the definition is essentially about the intentional mass killing, of part or all of a group of people. The UN definition says ethnic, national, racial, or religious group. I mean, I've done some writing about Stalin where I said I think it should be expanded to include social and economic groups,
political groups
mm-hmm. or other kinds of groups. If, for example, you can imagine a situation where someone would fall on or attack people because of their sexual orientation. I mean, it happened a little bit in the Second World War. I mean, Hitler did attack homosexuals.
The Pink Triangle.
It's not considered a genocide because he didn't purposely want to kill all or a substantial part of that group, as far as we know. But, for example, he went against handicapped people, until mm-hmm. it was stopped, by some civilian protests. But essentially, in other words, it's a purposeful attack on a group of people, as a group of people. So some things, like a massacre, are not necessarily genocide. A massacre can be, a group of soldiers, a My Lai killing a bunch of Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. It's an awful, terrible crime. It's a crime against humanity, by the way. Let me say one more thing. The international courts have been very good, I think, about defining and working with the term of genocide in a kind of legal way. Some historians, some scholars say, well, we shouldn't pay attention to the legal literature. I think that's a mistake. I think we have to sort of combine, a historical, sociological, psychological, and legal view of what genocide is. If you look at the legal view, then the International Criminal Court has three different levels of crime. There's the crime of genocide, which is considered by most courts to be the crime of crimes, the worst thing you can do, right, internationally. Mm-hmm. Then there's a level called crimes against humanity, and this includes a lot of different kinds of crimes: massacre, forced deportation, ethnic cleansing, systematic rape. After the war in Bosnia, systematic rape became a crime against humanity. systematic torture, and a series of other crimes. There are about 10 or 12 of them which are defined as crimes against humanity. And then there are war crimes, crimes committed during war, like My Lai would be a classic case of a war crime. Clearly, you know, there are permeable boundaries between those three different levels of crime, three different kinds of serious international crime. But I think genocide is distinguished by a very high bar for talking about intentional mass murder. This makes things like famine tough to think about in terms of genocide. I mean, I read about the Irish famine, and there's a lot of purposeful killing in the sense that when the Irish die, and we know hundreds of thousands died as a result, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't remember what the exact death toll was. But it's hard for me, you know, to think about that as genocide without mass murder or murder, direct murder being involved. Now, there are other crimes. For example, Stalin, I mentioned Stalin. I had worked on the famine, the Ukrainian famine. The Ukrainian famine, which took place in 1932-33, also killed, we don't know exactly, but let's say 3 to 5 million Ukrainians. Was that genocide? You know, I think it was. There's a lot of evidence, you know, that Stalin was directly trying to get the Ukrainians and that he deprived them. I mean, the Irish could leave, right? And they could get out, which they did in large numbers.
Which is perhaps what the English wanted.
Right, which is what they want. The Ukrainians couldn't. They were objects, you know, they were objects of genocidal intent, is my view. Mm-hmm. Now, again, you know, I can see that people could argue differently about the Irish famine. I can see people could argue differently about the Ukrainian famine. But in the case of Ukraine, you know, I've become convinced after doing a lot of work, and you have to do a lot of work first. You know, historians are hopefully very skeptical people, you know, so, and they're skeptical of what other historians say. So you know, in many of these episodes, if I'm not clear, you know, I need to do more work. And in the Irish famine, I need to do more work. Ukrainian famine, I'm convinced.
You know, as I was looking over the numbers, you know, I was thinking how many genocides have occurred since, say, around 1900? And, I can think of – everybody thinks of the Holocaust. Recent history, Rwanda, and what happened in the former Yugoslavia. Some people will know about what happened at the end of the Ottoman Empire, the Armenian genocide, which is pretty well documented. But I was, you know, the Ukrainian wheat famine that could qualify as a genocide. Most people are totally unaware of that. How many of these things took place, say, in the last 100 years or so?
No, it's absolutely, you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things you learn, by the way, I'm now a college professor for more than 40 years, right? So one of the things I've learned, and this is totally off the subject, but is that you never know all the universities and colleges in the United States. You never know them, you know, because there are so many.
Right.
And you never, you know, you just never know them all. And similarly with genocide over history, you just will never know them all. And in some cases, you know, purposely, they're concealed. You know, people don't reveal them. They take place in parts of the world that are not open to other parts of the world. I learn of new genocides, you know, since I've been working, like I said, since the mid-90s, really, in a serious way on genocide and ethnic cleansing. I keep learning new things, you know, new horrid episodes. And by the way, some of them are done by communist societies. Some of them are done against communists. I'll give you an example. 1965-66 in Indonesia, there was the mass murder of close to 600,000 Indonesian communists by the Indonesian military regime. So if you open yourself up, you know, to ideas of the political groups can also be victims of genocide. And you see what happened, which was tearing these people apart, killing them, massacring them, murdering them, awful tortures and stuff like this, with the purpose of eliminating them all. I mean, there's genocide. There is, by the way, a new film, which I will recommend to you and to others, which we're going to show at Stanford in a couple of weeks, called The Act of Killing, which talks in particular about this Indonesian episode. But the truth is, I never knew anything about it until I started doing a little bit of reading, and then people pointed this out to me, and I started doing a little more reading, and then I realized, you know, this is a full-blown episode of genocide. Another one in the modern era that we don't talk about very much, and again, partly it has to do with the fact that the United States government in some ways was complicit, was in Guatemala, mm-hmm. where essentially, you know, what happens is that the Guatemalan government turns on what they call, you know, leftist insurrectionaries, but they're basically Mayan Indians. They don't separate what a Mayan Indian, you know, for them, the Mayan Indians are communists, are insurrectionaries.
They're collectivists.
Are evil. They're, you know, they put them in a group.
Right. Right.
And they attempt to destroy them. And it's a, you know, it's a terrible story. It's a story, again, with a lot of American complicity, because when it comes to genocide against leftist groups, we tend to turn the other way, right? And so it's a pretty nasty and terrible thing that the Guatemalan people, and here in particular the Mayans, Indian various groups of Mayan Indians went through. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. The 20th century is filled with these stories and with these episodes, many of which don't cross our radar whatsoever. One more, by the way, I mean, here in Oklahoma, you know about Indians, right?
Right.
About Native Americans, and nobody has to tell you about that. But, you know, I've been in Northern California most of my life and around Stanford in one way or another as a student and now as a professor. You know, until I started doing this work, I had no idea that not, you know, 2 hours from me up in Mendocino County, you know, a group of Indians called the Yuki were totally eliminated in the post-Gold Rush period. Totally eliminated. Mm-hmm. I mean, by the end of the 19th century, there were no Yuki left. And this was, you know, part of this was a settler genocide, a fairly typical one against, you know, American Indian tribes. You know, some were genocide, some I would say were not genocide. I mean, I think with Indians you have to kind of differentiate who you're talking about and when and what and be specific. In the case of Yukis, it's quite specific, quite clear what happened. 18,000 Indians, you know, wiped out by the settlers because they wanted their land. Simple as that. And they, you know, this was not a matter of driving. They drove them actually into a reservation, but the reservation was small and didn't support the life of the Indians, and there were periodic attacks. And so I had no idea, you know. I mean, I lived in that area all those years, and I had no idea the genocide occurred in my backyard, as it were.
Unfortunately, it happens in too many people's backyards
right.
around the world.
Right.
Well, Norman Neymark, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Professor Norman Neymark is a professor of East European History at Stanford University, where he directs their Global Studies Division and is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He'll be giving the University of Tulsa's Cadenhead Settle Memorial Lecture in History this evening at 7:30 at the University of Tulsa's Terrell Hall Auditorium on the history of genocide. The lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.